You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, music fans, welcome back to Modern Musicology. We have a great show lined up for you this time, but first, say hello to our co-hosts, author, journalist, and DJ Rob Levy.
Konnichiwa.
And drummer, singer, songwriter, bird enthusiast, Stephanie Seymour.
Hello, everybody.
That was so quiet. And
I'm not going to say konnichiwa like Rob, but I just did. Right. So whatever.
So this week we are going to be talking about The Greatest Night in Pop. This is a documentary that first aired on Netflix on January 29, 2024, and it is about the making of We Are the World. And I'm a little, I don't know, the timing of this thing surprises me because, you know, this actually came out, the song came out in 1985. It was recorded in 1985. It was written December of 1984. It's so close to big anniversaries, but not really lining up with any of them. It just seems weird. But here we are. This documentary came out in the beginning of this year, 2024. And it is all about the night when We Are the World was recorded. The single was released on March 7th, 1985. It was recorded in January following the American Music Awards, and the song became the fastest selling single of all time and the first single to be certified multi-platinum. It actually went quadruple platinum. There was a global simulcast of the song on April 5th, which in most countries is Good Friday. And it was organized by, this is something I'd completely forgotten about, organized by two DJs right here in Georgia. Oh. And they literally got on the phone and called radio stations around the world and said, can you please play this song at this time on this date?
Wow. So
that's pretty crazy. And then the song ended up raising reportedly $80 million, which in modern money comes out to $222 million for famine relief. So you guys, do you remember where you were in 1985 when this song came out? And do you remember the hubbub around this song? Where were you when you first heard it?
I do remember the thing about the rate, like that it was going to be broadcast on the same day. I didn't know that the two guys were from Atlanta, though. That's pretty interesting. And that they coordinated the entire world.
That's quite a feat.
Especially, I mean, if you think about it, yeah, right? No cell phone. Mm-hmm. No. I remember that. I don't know if I remember like the exact moment I heard it or anything, but I do remember that it was being simulcast like that. First time broadcast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember whether you heard the song first or saw the video first?
I believe I saw it. You know, I feel like I must have been watching MTV. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I heard it first.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was at a place called Streetside Records, which used to be near my house. And it was fantastic because it was near the old Grandview bookstore. So I would go to the bookstore to buy my nerd Doctor Who stuff, like in real time as it came out. And I'd walk across the street and get my punk rock on and get records. And I remember coming in there and they were all excited about this. And they were sort of doing a name check of all the people that were on it. Mm-hmm. And different people, like, so they were like, kind of like a roll call. Oh, is, you know, Vince Neil on it or, you know, whatever. And I don't remember if I heard all of it there or if I heard it, but then I definitely remember it being on MTV. I remember when MTV did the premiere of it, it was like the world sort of stopped and people like just sort of like I remember on the news, they had people lining up downtown in front of a department store where they had the TVs in the windows and people were there standing there watching
Yeah.
The video feed of it. I also remember it being on regular TV, which I thought for a music video was weird. Oh, right. Yeah. It's like, this is on regular TV. So I definitely remember the video permeating everywhere. I remember seeing the 7-inch single, which apparently I own, everywhere. Like literally anytime you went to the record store, there it was. I remember that much. I remember seeing Tina Turner on the local news here talking about it when it came out. And those are kind of my sort of primal memories of it.
Yeah. I'm sure that I first saw it on MTV as well. They had the big premiere of it. And so I'm sure that I was there and saw that live as it happened. But man, I remember just that song being everywhere. Because, you know, this follows Do They Know It's Christmas, which came out toward the end of 1984. And that's what inspired this song as a response, as a, you know, let's get on this train. And it happened really fast. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I don't know if you remember this. There was, you know, because if you have the single or the LP, it's got a list of all the people that are on it. And then there was the video. There was a version of the video that had captions, you know, that said Cyndi Lauper and Kenny Loggins underneath it. But there was a version for the radio where there was like a narrator that would announce who this next soloist is.
What? I like, never heard that. I don't think I ever heard
that. Oh my gosh.
That.
It was crazy. And it's like Kenny Loggins. And then he sings his line and then Bob Dylan.
That's so weird.
So it was like audio liner notes almost.
Oh no, my gosh. I don't remember that, but
if any of our listeners remember hearing that, let us know. Yeah. So what did you guys think of the documentary? Just like overall, you know, impressions of it. And then we'll get into the details in a minute. But what did you think of it?
You know, what I thought was, first of all, I learned things that I just really never knew about it. I think back then I just knew that it was this big event happening. I did not understand the making of it at all. You know, I didn't know it happened in one night. I didn't know it happened one night after the American Music Awards. I didn't know it happened after that and that they were all there till like, you know, 8 a.m. or whatever.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they didn't know their parts. I mean, this was something that it was just a thing that I knew was coming out. And I figured, you know, hey, when they must have rehearsed this all. And, you know, it's like you see the video put together very well. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, behind the scenes things in the video itself, but you don't really ever get that the impression of the pressure they were under to record and stuff like that. So I thought it was amazing to really see that whole behind the scenes.
The thing that I didn't realize is that, you know, they're coming up on the end of 84 and this idea gets suggested and Lionel and Michael are going to write the song they're so busy and they've got so many other things going on and they're like, well,
Lionel Richie is hosting the American Music Awards, you know?
And they're like, we'll get to it. And then it was Quincy who said, hey, we're going to do this right after the AMAs, because that's the only time everybody will be in one place. So at this point you have 2 weeks to write this song. And the thing that I was blown away by was the kind of Lionel describing the writing process. I could have watched an hour of just learning about the writing process.
Yeah. Like going to Michael Jackson's house and like, there's a snake right there next to him. They had to like he had never been to his house, but he's known him for years, but you know, and that was just so, and that Michael's kind of joking around and whatever, but like the pressure that Lionel felt, I think more than Michael, you know?
Yeah.
But that they actually did it. They did it. You know, when the pressure was on, they did it.
Mm, yeah.
So I guess with me, it was a lot of the behind the scenes stuff as well, particularly the egos at play and things. And, you know, it's weird because I watched the making of Live Aid. So I should have just assumed, or not Live Aid, Band Aid. I should have assumed that this would be similar, but I just thought, like, oh, they just all went in a room and did. I had no idea that it was just the chaos and bedlam that it was. And I had no idea, you know, we talk about going to Michael Jackson's house and Lionel Richie's hard at work writing. And Michael Jackson's like, oh, say hi to my chimp. I always sort of respected Lionel Richie musically later in life when I sort of knew more about his work in music. But I really love how he sort of walked everyone through this with the film.
Yeah.
And sort of like, it was kind of like having a museum guide walk you through an exhibition or something. And he sort of like explains the process of, this is how we wrote it. This is how we got all the people. And then, you know, this is how we got everybody to stick around. And I just thought that was really great. And, you know, Stevie Wonder was busy trying to write the soundtrack for Lady in Red, or Woman in Red, the soundtrack for that he ended up doing. I just called Say I Love You for. So he was not available to completely work on the songwriting process. But there's this whole backstory about Stevie Wonder and sort of how they have to dance around that ego of Stevie Wonder.
When he gets to the studio and he's pretty much already, it's done. The song's done. He's trying to suggest stuff, but it's really done.
So that was kind of interesting, you know, to watch, you know, Lionel Richie have to navigate a room with Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder. And, you know, so this had, I think the biggest thing for me was just the profound amount of delicate maneuvering that Lionel Richie had to do.
And Quincy.
It didn't seem like Quincy though was doing a lot of the day-to-day interaction with the celebs, but so Lionel had to sort of wrangle all the egos and get everybody lined up. And I also had no idea when they were lining up who was going to sing where, and they show them placing the name tags on the floor of who's going to stand where and stuff. I'm like, okay, this is way above my organizational skill level. This is the worst work retreat ever. But I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I have not thought about We Are the World probably since 1986. So it was really interesting to sort of sit through that.
I liked their description of assigning. They had to select who was going to get a solo, and then assigning the solo parts to each of the soloists, where they're like, okay, this person's range fits this line. This person's range fits this line. This person has a very gravelly voice, so we want to hear that here. This person has a very smooth voice, so that would be perfect for this line. And then on top of that, then they had to think about who's going to stand next to each other. I thought that was so crazy.
Yeah. And also, just so they did think about those lines in advance and who would be best suited for them. But then there was also stuff like happening on the fly, like when Huey Lewis and Kim Carnes, like I think Huey came in on Kim's line or something, but that was so great. They were like, yes, do that. So that they sung that last thing together with Cyndi Lauper doing the high part over it. So it's like, it was a sort of a mixture of already planned things. And then, you know, what sounded good in the moment too.
It's also one of the things that I really enjoyed was hearing some of the, you know, because they recorded most of these parts three or four or more times. And it was cool to see them like doing the recordings, and they do a take, and then they like say, well, okay, that was okay, but let's do it better. And they back it up and they do another take. And when you get to that take that ends up on the record, you recognize it instantly.
Yes.
I loved that.
There was a Huey Lewis one that, I was like, that's the
especially in that bit with Kim and Cyndi, where they sing it so differently each time, but then the third or fourth time that you hear it, you're like, that's the one that's on the record. It's very so cool.
And I feel like I have, you know, in 1985, I mean, I was just such a child of the 80s musically, and a lot of the people there, I was not, you know, into when I, at that time, I mean, I know who Diana Ross is, and I was, you know, I know who she is. And Lionel, same thing, like all these, you know, there was the older kind of crew that was there. And looking back on it now, it's like so mind blowing that those people were all there with like the people that I love then, Cyndi Lauper, you know, the younger kind of 80s music scene, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a new respect kind of for people like Bob Dylan, who did not have to be there. And that guy seemed pretty confused for some of it, but he just did it. He stuck around. He's Bob Dylan. He did not have to. He stuck around. Right. He, like Stevie helped him, especially with his own solo thing. And he did it. You know, it's like, that was really like kind of heartwarming.
Speaking of sticking around, Waylon Jennings did not.
No.
I thought that was hilarious. He's like, Ain't no country boy ever sung Swahili. I'm out of here.
Yeah, this did not cast several people in a very positive light. No. Waylon is one of them.
Yeah. No. Al Jarreau was another one where he's like drunk and not.
Oh, well, not it was kind of funny though.
Seriously.
I know. But I felt bad for like Sheila E., you know?
Dude.
That was kind of, in her opinion, she was there because they wanted Michael to, I mean, they wanted Prince to show up and, you know, he did.
She's kind of the new girl on the scene, you know? Yeah. She and Cindy both were kind of in their career, the youngest ones in that group. And you know what's funny is that she performed on the AMAs and they have a little clip of it.
Yes.
That performance is burned into my brain because it was such a huge impression on me because I remember, you know, at the time, this is 84 when her first solo album comes out and Glamorous Life is becoming a big hit and the video is playing all the time. And I'm thinking, you know, this is okay. This isn't bad. And, you know, it has her in the video, like playing her timbales and cowbells and stuff. And I'm like, is she really?
Yeah.
What's really going on here, you know? And so the AMAs come around and she fucking tore those fucking drums up. And I was blown away. I was like huge Sheila E. fan. And I remember very clearly my sister, we were still kind of young. I was like maybe high schoolish and she was junior high or something like that. And she goes, well, she's pretty good for a girl. I was like, she's good for anybody.
I know, she's sick.
Oh my God.
But you're right. It was like, you know, that was her breakout.
Yeah, absolutely. But then she walks from that into, hey, you want to do a solo? By the way, is Prince going to come?
I know, and they waited. Yeah,
no Prince. And so she's like, you know what? I'm gone.
I guess you see her on the chorus, but then you don't see her at all. Yeah.
Right. Speaking of the chorus, there's a couple of odd inclusions. Like, I have never understood why Dan Aykroyd is there.
Yeah, I know. Why
like
did they
from want- 1985, I saw the video and I'm like, is that fucking Dan Aykroyd?
It must have been a Blues Brothers thing, and it must have been like just star power, like the TV guy, I think.
Maybe.
I think that is the year that they did the tour with him and the other Belushi brother, where they toured as the Blues Brothers.
So that would make more sense.
I think they brought it back, but I know.
I'll have to look at the dates on that. But I think that lines up.
A pretty big blues and soul guy too.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, kind of a moderate musical career, you know. But still. I'm guessing that he's sort of like somebody's plus one, or I don't know.
Because they said they really wanted him. They specifically said. I don't know.
I think if it had been a big year for the Blues Brothers in 1985, I would have thought, oh, okay, that's why Dan Aykroyd is there. But in 1985, I thought, why is he there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure about all that, but we'll have to check that timeline.
And there was just some people that I didn't realize that they're some of the Pointer Sisters that were there. Like there's
all three of them.
Yeah. All three. I remember thinking back then, like, I don't know, people look familiar, but I don't know everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just some of the people I wasn't clear about, I think.
And I'm surprised about the Pointers not getting a solo. And I wonder if it's a case of we can't give one act three of the solos, or there's not a place in the song for a good three-part harmony, which, of course, there turned out to be. But they were 83, 84, 85. They were huge.
Yes.
You know, they were burning. So that was a surprising exclusion.
I mean, that was just another thing. Like, I guess there were quite a few people that you would think would have really a soul and they didn't. And then some surprising ones that did, I think. I mean, you know, okay, I understand why Bruce had I guess. You know, he sounded great.
Come on, it's Bruce Springsteen.
I think a lot of it is that, you know.
Oops, sorry.
Sort of last minute. Okay, we've only got one night. Throw it together. We're not overthinking this. That's kind of what I think it is. I think the longer this went on and they thought about vocals, the more this process becomes nuts. because then people start getting really finicky. And I think it was like, okay, this voice is this. And it's like, who can we get? Oh, Huey, you're right here.
They could have driven themselves crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's since you mentioned that, let me jump in real quick. Here's the surprising thing. They put Huey in because that was the line that they had assigned to Prince, and Prince never showed up. How different would that line have been had Prince done it?
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't even hear it now. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Rob.
No, I just think it's interesting that they're dealing with all of those different dynamics of getting all these people in the room. And I think it's at some point, you know, like, okay, we've only got these people for so long. And then I think, you know, okay, Huey Lewis, pretty humble guy. Kim Carnes, not a giant ego. Cyndi Lauper, great. They got a lot of people that were really easy to work with other people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It didn't turn into a personality contest, right?
Yeah.
So I think there was some of that involved as well.
And it was so sweet, like how humble like Huey was. And when he was interviewed for the whole documentary, I mean, he was really genuinely like, I cannot believe I'm standing next to these people, you know? He was so nervous. Right. We're talking about how nervous his heart was beating out of his chest. And
right.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing too is, a lot of these people are starstruck themselves.
Yeah, like he was.
I think Springsteen was talking about, that's Stevie Wonder, right? You know? Yeah. So that was kind of interesting too, you know. So,
and they all like autograph each other's sheet music. I wonder how many of those exist now.
Right? Is there any one of them in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
You know, that's a good point. When I'm there in a few weeks, I will look and see.
That's right.
Yes, I'm going back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Woo-hoo! Super excited about that. I just wonder, man, if that fell into like the hands of a like private collector or something, how much would that be worth?
Yes, all those autographs.
Holy cow.
You know something I was thinking about I was watching the documentary, but also afterwards, like, I mean, if I was 25 or even 30, I could definitely be like, okay, I'm going to the American Music Awards. I'll be there all night. And then till 8 in the morning, I'll be recording. You know, just think about people who were in their 50s and 60s there, and maybe in some cases 70s even, I don't know, but that's brutal. Like, and they did it, you know. That's something that I'll keep thinking about too, like, wow, man, they went into like 6 in the morning, and then Diana Ross didn't even want to leave. She was so like sad that it had to be over.
Yeah, that was sweet.
I think they had a lounge area where like a lot of those people probably like took Ray Charles somewhere to chill and said, we'll come get him when we need him or something. I'm sure they had stuff like that.
Oh, I know. But you think of it. But it's still
pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's still a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. And then, you know, you're getting to your tired points and then trying to get a second when you're starting to like unravel and like tempers starting to flare a little bit, or just like people being impatient. You could see that happening too, but they all came together, you know?
Yeah. So we talked about the AMAs was that night. And this is, you know, the wrap up of, this is January of 85. So this is basically the wrap up of the whole like 1984 musically. And it's just insane to go and look at the nominees and the winners for this thing, because all of the people that are on that recording were all nominated or won something that night. And for in the category that this is so interesting, in the category favorite soul R&B male artist, the competitors were Lionel Richie, Michael Jackson, and Prince. Lionel won, or as Michael says, Lionel won. And I just think that is so interesting. The favorite female soul and R&B was Tina Turner, Chaka Khan, and Sheila E. So Sheila E is new on the scene, and she's already nominated in this category. Tina Turner is a legend, but she has had, you know, she had that time away from the spotlight for a long time after she and Ike, you know, went their separate ways, and she struggled with, you know, her career. And then Private Dancer comes along. So 84 is just as big a year for Tina as it is for anybody here.
Yeah.
Favorite soul R&B group was won by the Pointer Sisters, and they didn't get solos or anything.
Right.
It's so interesting to look at all this stuff. And Lionel hosted the thing, performed twice, and won a shit ton of awards.
Like that seven.
Night. So he was he was all over that show. I can't even imagine.
And then him saying that the only thing he could talk about when he got home finally that morning was the We Are the World session. Like, he won all those, you know, he hosted the show, he won these, but the thing that to him in his mind, that was the biggest thing he did was the We Are the World session.
Right. Right.
And how important it was to him. You know what I was going to bring up too is what I thought was very strategic and smart of them was that they brought Bob Geldof in to speak to them before they recorded. And because, they're all flying in from American Music Awards. They're like, you know, hey, we're having a party here. But Bob Geldof, you know, brings them down to earth and say, this is why we're doing it. And you are helping your own people, you know, and, you know, we're coming together for this reason. And this is what the facts are, you know?
Right.
And you could see in their faces, like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, nobody can bring a room down like Bob Geldof.
I noticed, you know, when I was watching that, the people that just looked absolutely sort of like affected, like the look on Kenny Rogers' face, like when they're talking about the famine and things, you're like, oh, wow. You know, there were some of them that were pronounced, you know, like Huey Lewis looked like he was just sort of like, jarred. So, and I thought the interviews they did around that were really good as well. You know, I think that the thing I really liked about it is sort of the flowing and the pacing of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. The flow and the pace and the interviews all, it told the story very well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that Lionel Richie being the person to sort of talk about the process of it was really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Huey Lewis being the secondary person.
Yes.
I thought was really a nice dynamic between both. Them just sort of gradually bringing in the archive footage that they had of stuff. And I thought that was interesting too, you know, and at the, you know, for me, this is interesting because in 1985, I'm more of a punk new wave kid than I am. You know, I know who's Springsteen. I mean, I know about Diana Ross. I knew more about the soul people than a lot of the rock people because of the house I grew up with, but I knew about Huey Lewis, right? I knew about Cyndi Lauper and I knew about Kim Carnes and Lindsey Buckingham, but there's a lot of people in there I didn't really understand the magnitude of them yet. Like,
that's what I meant.
You know,
yeah.
Springsteen was like Born in the USA. It's like, okay, you know, this didn't do anything for my thoughts about Dylan. I mean, once I saw the documentary, yes, but my 1985 brain was like still dismissive of Dylan.
Totally. That's what I was saying in the beginning. Then,
you know, me too, actually.
I always thought Jackson Brown was in this, but I guess he wasn't.
Nope.
So I have these memories of certain musicians that I like remember. Like, I just remember, you know, Lionel Richie was friggin' everywhere and it got really old, you know, because like a lot of these records were everywhere on the radio.
Yeah.
So you kind of got lost by that. I did. This is the kind of the time that I really began to realize just how important Tina Turner was. So she was, this was, you know, many ways one of my gateway drugs to Tina Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I knew Diana Ross from hearing my brother play the Supremes like literally every day for like the first 15 years of my life. So there's some of that where, you know, where it's kind of by osmosis, you know who these people are, but these are not people I listened to musically at that time in my life. So for me, it's interesting to go back in hindsight and sort of listen to this and appreciate it more like, you know, like a, I'm going to use the comparison of an older wine because you're like, once you have the knowledge of time and you listen to music as you get older, you sort of appreciate who some of these people are.
That's exactly and, right. Yeah.
You know, unlike Band-Aid, which had a lot of people who are of the moment, when you watch the Band-Aid lineup or look at the Band-Aid lineup, it is very much people that are rock stars of that time.
Yeah.
When you look at the roster for USA for Africa, it is very much, these are legacy artists. This is like a fascinating collection of like American songwriters and musicians and performers that are pretty representative of the last, you know, 50 years of music of that time. So it's pretty astounding when you look at the level of talent. And I did not appreciate that at the time of hearing it. Just like it's name after name after name of people in this thing. It's just like, and you know, nobody hit anybody. So it's that for me, that's the big astounding thing about
they're I don't like, I don't know, the word legacy makes it sound like their moment has passed,
but I can't think of a different word.
They're legendary. But they were still having, they were still at the peak of what they were doing in 1984, 1985. Right. And they're still so it wasn't that, like they were past tense. It's like they are very much dominating the current scene.
Yeah. And it's Ray Charles had a resurgence after this. Yes. You know, Stevie Wonder did too as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. These are very much people.
Yeah.
I love the perspective of the cameraman also. I was really
going to say that too.
Oh, really? Yeah. That was such a great idea that they used him. And he was so happy to be there. And he's like, I can't believe Bruce Springsteen is standing 2 feet away from me. And I got my camera in his face, you know?
No, the funny thing was that midway through, he's like, I can't believe I'm getting paid to film all this. Right. And at the end, they're like, well, ain't nobody getting paid. And he's like, well, at least I've got a good story that came out of it.
Yeah, that was really
he was great. I loved seeing him.
Yeah, I also like Springsteen, too, who is very candid, you know, and that whole background about Bruce likes to rest after the tour, you know, and he got on a plane to fly across the country.
Yeah.
To do this. And his voice, I mean, I never noticed his voice was shot.
Yeah.
Until, I didn't either. You know, you listen to that, you know, and then that's something I never thought about. Like, yeah, that board in the USA tour. I just remember that was a slog, you know,
but it was a long tour. I mean, he worked hard on that tour.
Yeah. So I think that speaks volumes that he's there.
Yeah.
You could say that though, anybody, I mean, yes, of course, him with a massive tour, that's kind of a given. Your voice is going to be, but you know, at 6 a.m. or whatever, maybe 4 a.m. when you're trying to do a solo part, Cyndi Lauper doing that high part right then, that could have easily not happened because, you know, you're tired and your voice isn't going to do the things it's going to do, you know, at 8 p.m.
Yeah. You know, the one that I thought kind of badly for was Kim Carnes because she was assigned one of the solo lines and she basically got 2 words out and they're like, hey, let's have other people sing with you.
Yeah,
so her solo Huey line Lewis. Turned into a trio line and she didn't really get that much of her own identity into the song.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's what I mean when they were talking about that they were doing things on the fly and that was just one of them. It's unfortunate, for her. But it's still, it's her. I mean, definitely can hear her.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I know.
People listening now might not know it's her, but.
No, people listening now might not know it's any one of those.
Well, you know it's Bob Dylan when you
hear
Bob
you know Dylan. It's Michael Jackson. But, you know. A lot, I think, Rob, just going back to your point and what I was sort of saying at the beginning, too, you know, people who I did not think were I could not stand Lionel Richie at that time. I was he was so uncool. I just was. But having a new appreciation, you know, as you get older, what these people.
Right.
Their legacy. Yeah. And then just what they. Even now, I'm not going to go put All Night Long on, but it's, can appreciate the fact that that was a huge hit single and, you know, one of a long line of his hits. So.
Right. One of the things that really stuck out to me was this whole thing about them trying to get Prince into the studio and waiting around to see if he'd show up and he never showed up. One of the big winners at the AMA that year and the Grammys that year was Purple Rain. And, you know, Prince had a huge 1984. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because he was sort of the press darling for a while now. I mean, ever since 1999 came out, he was very much on the rise. And then Purple Rain came out and he was he exploded. Until this, because I don't know if you remember this or not, but he kind of got skewered by the press and raked over the coals and criticized for not participating in We Are the World. Like people expected him. Like, this is your job. You are the biggest artist on the planet right now. It is your job to do this. And people were really unhappy that he didn't participate. Like, they were offended by it. It was crazy.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember him sort of not taking any type of questions about it. And I remember it coming up a couple times, you know, and I actually remember people saying, where's Prince? Prince isn't in this, man. Where's Madonna? You know?
Right, right. Madonna's another one.
Yeah. So I kind of remember, you know, the people that people didn't talk about, you know.
I wonder if Madonna was ever even asked.
I was just going to say, did they invite her?
Yeah, because then she never got mentioned. She was in a clip.
Yes.
AMAs, but they never talked about her. Really.
I was kind of fascinated too that like they got Bette Midler,
who sort
of represents a totally different dynamic than the rest of them. And, you know, she's not in it very much, but just the fact that like, you know, the different people that they had that were kind of in these interesting circles. I thought that was another interesting person they had that was kind of interesting.
But on the Prince thing, he did sort of a clapback song. It was called Hello, and it was the B-side of Pop Life when it was released as a single. And it was basically criticizing people for getting on his ass about this.
Well, really?
But he also did, he also did contribute a song to the album, though. We Are the World was an album that had the song as the single. And then Chicago and other groups, Huey Lewis did a song and, you know, some other people. And Prince, Prince and the Revolution did a song called For the Tears in Your Eyes, which is a great song. But it's like people sort of ignored that when they criticized him for not being on the recording. And then the following year, he also chose not to participate in Live Aid, but he did provide a video that could be included in the broadcast. And it was basically a slightly slowed down acoustic version of For the Tears in Your Eyes. That was just him and Wendy and Lisa on piano and two guitars. And it is phenomenal. It is so amazing. So I just thought that whole year that Prince had with starting off with this was super interesting.
Yeah. And I agree. It's weird that he wasn't there and he probably got too much flack for not being there. But you know what? They got, you know, look who they did get. I know. You can't get everyone, and someone's always going to have a reason why they can't go, you know, or what. Just, you know, who knows?
He's super private. He's super shy. He doesn't do stuff like that a lot.
Sheila, so, he was just like, I mean, he's not going to come. Like, I know he's not coming, so no, don't
he's
wait.
Not gonna come.
But they were waiting, you know, but she's like, no, he's not going to be there.
Since her name has come up a few times, super quickly, Rob, you just saw Sheila.
Yeah, so there is a tour of her that's coming. She's going to be doing, I think, City Winery and a couple other places that's all salsa stuff. And her show here was all sort of like it was a fundraiser. So it was a greatest hits.
Oh, that's cool.
Show she did. She does like a Prince melody and Glamorous Life and things like that. The other thing too is it's kind of a sensory experience as well.
So she's got a new album coming out called Bailar, which is a salsa album. And the first single has her and Gloria Estefan, and it's amazing. It is so fucking phenomenal.
Awesome.
But, you know, we talk about her being a new artist because her first solo album came out in 84. But by the time that we got to 1984, that was like most people had never heard of her before. So everybody thinks of her as a new artist, but she had a hell of a career already by that time because she was a session player and on tours. So she had played or toured the world at that point with Lionel Richie and Diana Ross and Billy Cobham and all these people. And, you know, her dad was in Santana for a while. I mean, she has this history that brings her to 1984, brings her to the attention of the general public. And everybody thinks, hey, look at this new chick on the scene. But no, she had been around for a while and had done some significant shit by that point.
Yeah. And it's just one of those things where anytime you think, oh, new artist because it's their first solo single or whatever. But half the people have done a million things before that, you know, to get to that point. So that's one of them.
Right. Right. You know, we were talking about seeing sort of the behind the scenes stuff. You know, they planned on filming the recording session and using that, editing it down, using it as the music video for this thing. Had they not done that, we might not have had any of that footage that we saw. And before everybody else shows up, Michael gets there and he just records some of his parts, and just seeing him by himself in the studio at the microphone, just running through his parts and his interaction with Quincy and doing take after take was, almost magical.
The camera, remember the cameraman was like, I can't believe that I'm seeing this, you know?
Right.
Yeah, right. That's so true. Him trying to figure out what he's going to sing here and there. That was so cool to see.
Another thing that kind of blew me away, because, you know, this is pre-internet. considerably pre-internet, is that after they finished recording the demo, they FedExed 50 copies of the cassette out to all the people who were going to do solos and sing in the choir and all that kind of stuff. Can you imagine having to FedEx all these packages that's just got a cassette tape in it? Here's your part.
No, and also you had to literally press on that thing to hand write those forms that, you know, with the copies and then doing all that like that. That's not just like they print a label at the post office. It was like, yeah,
that there was were some really interns that were exhausted.
Yeah. That oh, was yeah, really exactly.
Great. One of my favorite things that was at the very end when they're showing just the car driving away or the limo driving away. And I think Lionel was telling the story, or someone was telling the story about how, oh, maybe it was Lionel. He was saying how I think Quincy Jones said something to him in the car, like, man, those white people sure brought it tonight. Like, you know, that was the greatest line. I was like, yes, they did.
You know, that makes me think of earlier when they show, little clips of the people arriving. Mm-hmm. And here's Kim Carnes' driver bringing her in, and here's somebody else. And then you see Kenny Rogers, he's just driving his, you know, crappy little car into the lot. And I just thought that was so Kenny Rogers. That was hilarious.
I know. That footage was priceless. And it's true. Like, I think the video people were kind of, remember, like, at one point, Quincy just turned around and he's like, be quiet. You know, you have to be quiet. And they're trying to do their job filming a video and they're bumping into shit and whatever. So I think it was a bit of a like, God, can you imagine just the circus it had to have been for everybody?
Oh, I can't even. Right. Right. You know. Can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Bring another bottle of wine.
Al Jarreau, oh my God.
Sorry, Al, you're cut off, buddy. Oh, that's so funny. So I'm just curious to know if watching this documentary changed your opinion of, does it broaden your vision of what We Are the World is? Does it make you hear the song differently now?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot of hokey stuff that happened with it too, like the point where everyone around the world listened to it at the same time and everybody held hands. And there's a lot of sort of like sub things that happened with it that kind of got hokey. And looking at it through the mirror of time, as opposed to in real time, when it was literally everywhere you went for 3 months and you're like, oh my God, just stop. Because it became, it got exhausting how much you heard this thing. So it did its job. But looking back, you know, now knowing who more of these artists are and more of their career and like, you know, more knowing more about Paul Simon and knowing more about, you know, Dylan and sort of like the personalities involved with like guys like that. Not that they're bad, but they're just, there's a lot of different dynamics to a lot of these people in the same room.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that part of it's interesting. Knowing that it's nice, you know, it does show a different side of Diana Ross than I think what people have been publicly told about Diana Ross. You know, she doesn't seem, you know, wacky or nutty. She seems like she's like full on alert and, you know, really attentive to it. And so I think now that I understand the catalog of these artists and their cachet, it makes it a little easier to kind of appreciate who some of these folks are, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
In 1985, I know Kim Carnes is like Betty Davis eyes. That's it. You know, I know Kenny Rogers is like the guy from The Gambler, you know, but you know these people a little more now. After time.
I agree. Right. And I was thinking also, you know, having been in a recording studio, however many millions of times, like it's hard to get three people to agree and to like, let's start this right now kind of thing. And I just can't, the pressure and the wrangling and just the effort that they showed, I'm talking about Lionel Richie, especially, and his grace under pressure is just pretty mind blowing. And I think he's pretty special.
Yeah, I agree. So, as we said, this song was released toward the beginning of 1985, and USA for Africa, which is a group that this was released under, and Band-Aid, who did Do You Know It's Christmas. All this stuff leads up to July 1985 Live Aid. And so next year is the 40th anniversary of Live Aid. Now, Rob knows how fucking obsessed I am with Live Aid. And we've done a show a few times now. We did some panels for like Dragon Con. And back when, before we started this podcast, we were just doing a YouTube show and we did a thing about Live Aid there. Expect, and I'm prepping both of you and the listeners, just expect that we are going to do something big next year for Live Aid for the 40th anniversary, because this is like my Woodstock. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And Anthony will be flying by private jet from Philadelphia to London to do the podcast.
Nice.
I was just going to say, like,
in London, and he will be finishing the podcast much later than the rest of us in Philadelphia.
Nice.
I was just going to say, Alan's actually going to create the first time machine, and we're going to back in time. We're going to be at Live Aid.
Every time somebody asks that question, if you had a time machine, what would you do with it? And I say the same damn thing every time. I say I would go to Woodstock. I would go to one of the shows that Bowie did on the Diamond Dogs tour, and I would take a GoPro with me and film it, because there is like no footage from that tour, and it's reportedly incredible. And I would go to both shows of Live Aid so I could be at both stadiums at the same time, because mm-hmm. it's a time machine. That's what I would do with a time. And I'd go see dinosaurs, of course, because, you know, I love dinosaurs. So that's my one musical sojourn. I'm going to go see dinosaurs. So anyway, be on the lookout for that next year. We're going to do a show about the 40th anniversary of Live Aid, and I'm so excited about it. I'm going to start planning it now. So we're going to take a quick break. We will be back in 30 seconds to wrap up our show. Don't go anywhere.
What if you could bring three experienced producers into your home each week to discuss your favorite movies and the people that made them? That's Tales from Hollywoodland. Your hosts, Arthur, Julian, and Steve, collectively have years of showbiz producing experience. Their weekly show is a fast-paced, fun, and very conversational experience, like spending a good time with your best movie-loving friends and family. Tales from Hollywoodland is available wherever fine podcasts are found. See you at the movies.
Welcome back. Here we are. All right. So we, as you know, we have sort of moved to a every 2 weeks schedule. However, we've had a number of interviews come our way. So in order to get all these people in that we have opportunities to chat with, we're going to be back 2 weeks with three in a row. So our next show in 2 weeks is going to be Ian Wright of the band The Jack Rubies. They have a new album coming out, and we're going to be chatting with him. The week after that, we're going to be talking to Michael Cardellone, who is the drummer, used to be the drummer with Damn Yankees and Accept, and currently plays with Lynyrd Skynyrd, and he is also an artist and has a gallery show coming up in May. And then the week after that, we are going to be talking to two members of Rock Royalty, Jeff Slate and Earl Slick. They both have new projects coming out that the other one is involved in. So I think that is going to be a really, really great discussion.
Oh, yeah.
All right, you guys, that's it for us this week. So, Stephanie, why don't you tell people where they can find more about you?
Okay. You can find me on Facebook at Stephanie Seymour Music. You could find me on Instagram at their_r_birds. You can find me. I also have a website, therearebirds.com. And you can find me on Bandcamp under my name, and then on all the streaming platforms like Spotify and stuff like that.
Ta-da! Groovy Tunes. What's up, Robbo? Where can people find you?
Well, right now you can find me in my living room. Oh,
you can. What's your address?
No. I'm not doing that again. people start bringing their zoos. So you can find me on Instagram at Rob_Levy. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Blue Sky and Twitter or X or Bejesus or whatever the hell that thing is called now. And also on Post as well. Not as often, but, you know, we didn't really know where, what was going to replace Twitter. So a bunch of us are on all these friggin' different things.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, you can find me most usually on the Insta and or I guess they call it the Gram. You can find me on the Gram and Facebook and probably Blue Sky more than the other stuff. So you can find me on all of those places. And you can also find me Wednesday nights on KDHX from 7 to 9 p.m. Central. It shows stream, the show streams. So if you want to listen to it online, you can at kdhx.org. And all the shows are archived for 2 weeks at kdhx.org. So you can listen to all the shows there. They're all streamed. And you can listen to it on the archive. And then Monday is the new fun day because I have a crazy day on Mondays. Mondays from 6 to 8, if you are on Greenwich Mean Time, which is 12 to 2 Central or 1 to 3 Eastern. You can listen to Antics on Louder Than War Radio online through Louder Than War Radio. You can listen to that. And all, as of this recording, 51 episodes of that, more than Aftermath, are available on the Mixcloud page for Louder Than War Radio. So you can go and hear all those anytime you want. They're all archived and streaming. And then Mondays from 6 to 8 Eastern, 5 to 7 Central, you can find me on the Face Radio with the Free Design. And then that show repeats on Tuesday mornings because people are insane and want to hear me in the morning with their coffee. You can hear that in the morning from 8 to 10 Eastern, 7 to 9 Central. And if you go to the Face Radio website, it's just thefaceradio.com. You can find the myriad of streaming platforms that that thing is on because it's on a ton of platforms. So
you don't have enough. You don't have enough things.
Yeah, because shit, I am exhausted just listening to you say all that shit.
Oh, well, you've got like 9 podcasts. What do
you got? Well, I don't, you know, but all of my stuff is collected in one place. You can just go to Cosmic Creator.
I have a link tree where you can find it all.
Well, I don't have a link tree. I just have a website. It's called Cosmic Press. K-O-Z-M-I-C Creative. Sorry, I said it wrong. .com. And you can jump there to all my books and all my podcasts. And maybe some other things coming out within the coming year. Anyway. So we will be back in 2 weeks with our conversation with Ian Wright of the Jack Rubies. So everybody join us then. Take care. Have a great 2 weeks and keep rocking on. And don't forget, we are the world. Well, we are.
It's our world. You inhabit it.
Right. All right. Bye, everybody.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.